Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you work anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. Today, we're talking about the subjectivity remaining in the government's very structured proposal evaluation process. This episode is brought to you by Skyway Acquisition. Becoming a Skyway community member makes it easier to navigate the complicated world of government contracting because you gain context from Skyway's team of former contracting officers. Go to skywaymember.com to get started with a personal membership, because without context, you're likely overlooking problems that you don't see. Okay, let's get started with this week's episode.
When I was a contracting officer, I had a source selection where we had a heated debate over the difference between a weakness and a significant weakness, in quotes.
So if the government is debating amongst themselves on the definitions of evaluation strengths and weaknesses, on proposal strengths and weaknesses versus significant weaknesses versus what's a deficiency, imagine the challenge that the contractors, the offerors, have trying to decide what to write based on the criteria that are in the RFP. I mean, the government wrote them and they're still having a debate. The contractors are reading them and trying to interpret them.
There's so much judgment in this, really, on both sides. In an attempt to settle the debate, or at least, move it along, it's worth noting that these terms, they are defined in the FAR. So significant weakness and weakness, they are defined. So at least for folks not to be shooting from the hip when they're trying to figure this out, we can talk through what the FAR says.
We can start with the FAR, but the terms can be very confusing if communications aren't open during the process, when they're allowed to be open. So once again, we're talking about communication. Before we do that, let's stop and say thanks.
The shout out this week goes to Jana Hinton. Jana is a contracts compliance advisor at Honeywell, and she's in the Kansas City, Missouri area. I want to thank Jana first for joining the Contracting Officer podcast group on LinkedIn, because that helps us see who's actually listening to the podcast. And secondly, I want to thank her for sharing the podcast content on LinkedIn, because the best way for people to find the information that we're giving away for free is for people like Jana to like it and share it on LinkedIn.
Thanks, Jana. Let's start today with FAR time, so everyone understands exactly where we're coming from. We're in FAR Part 15, Contract by Negotiation, right at the beginning. 15.000. I don't know why you need three zeros after the dot, because there's nothing else there. This is the scope of Part 15, and it says, this part prescribes policies and procedures governing competitive and non-competitive negotiated acquisitions. A contract awarded using other than sealed bidding procedures is a negotiated contract. Why did I read that? I read that because this applies to everything except for sealed bidding, and that's important to understand. This isn't a niche thing that we're talking about. We're talking about a large chunk of the FAR here. You may have noticed it says competitive and non-competitive negotiated acquisitions. We're talking about competitive today. Because competitive acquisitions have proposals that need to be evaluated and ranked. And how does the government rank them? Based on the evaluation factors that they included in the RFP.
Here's where we are. So the government releases the RFP, and it contains a complete list, as much as can be possible, a complete list of what to submit and how it will be evaluated. In other words, what counts in the process. Then the offerors submit their proposals. Then the government reviews those proposals against the stated criteria that they put out in the RFP, and then assigns strengths, weaknesses, et cetera, based on that review. So that's where we are.
You started this out by talking about a debate about the difference between a weakness and a significant weakness, and then we said, hey, the FAR helps us here. FAR 15.001.
Now you do need the three decimal points, because there's actually a one in there.
Right. 15.001 is definitions. Here's where it defines what is a weakness, what is a significant weakness, and what is a deficiency. Before I read those, let's talk about what is a strength.
It's important to note that a strength is not defined in this part of the FAR.
But a strength is generally described as a feature of a proposed approach or solution in a contractor's proposal that delivers an appreciable value to the government in the context of this procurement.
In other words, it's something that is valuable to the government. It may be something that's valuable to the world, but it needs to be valuable to the government in this acquisition. That's how you define a strength. That's how I defined it when I was a contracting officer.
And I suppose that you could also argue about how big of a strength it is. Is it, is there a significant strength or a super strength or a mega strength, or is it just something good? The FAR sticks to defining weaknesses.
Seems kind of cynical.
Yeah. This is helpful, but not definitive. A weakness means a flaw in the proposal that increases the risk of unsuccessful contract performance. A significant weakness in the proposal is a flaw that appreciably increases the risk of unsuccessful contract performance. Okay, so the only difference in those sentences is appreciably increases.
Which is a totally judgmental word.
A deficiency is defined as a material failure of the proposal to meet a government requirement or a combination of significant weaknesses in a proposal that increases the risk of unsuccessful contract performance to an unacceptable level. So if you have a deficiency, you miss the boat and it's not awardable.
Yeah, that's the key factor. It's to an unacceptable level. There's risk and then there's unacceptable risk. And deficiency is where we get into that.
Okay, let's talk about why this difference between weakness and significant weakness and the judgment involved is important.
I'm going back to my baseball metaphors.
You love baseball.
It's so easy to make metaphors for baseball in life. The evaluation results, the strengths and weaknesses, they're kind of like the strike zone in baseball. As I may have mentioned before, I'm a manager on my son's baseball team. And one of the things you do before the game is you meet with the umpire. So you meet with the umpire and the other manager. So it's called the plate meeting. And at the plate meeting, we'll discuss things like, what is the strike zone? And in youth baseball, sometimes the strike zone is a little bit bigger because they want to keep the game moving. One of the examples, the up and down. What's the up and down defined as? So they may say the up and down is knees, from the knees of the athlete up to the numbers, where the numbers are on their chest. Or it may even be to armpits. That's a really big strike zone, but if they tell you ahead of time, that's the up and down. The side to side might be one ball width on either side of the plate. So technically, the ball may not actually be over the plate and be called a strike, but it's because they want to expand the strike zone. Because if you make a strike zone the size of the MLB for a 12-year-old, you're going to have a walk fest because not many kids can consistently hit that tiny spot, right? So as a manager of the team, I need to know what the guidelines are. If they don't follow their guidelines, I can question it, of course. I'm not going to win, of course, but I do get to question it. And I could protest. But this is youth baseball, so it's not the analogy is not quite linear.
To be clear, the strike zone is defined in the rule book. Even in big league baseball, the strike zone is defined. It's important in youth baseball that both sides, the team and the umpire, understand that I'm going to interpret a little bit differently for a good reason in youth baseball. In pro ball, they may not speak specifically about that, but they definitely know the tendencies of the different umpires, how they interpret the strike zone over time.
And they're having a plate meeting in the majors, and maybe that's what they're talking about. They're deciding what the strike zone is going to be. I doubt it, but you know, they could be.
They probably don't have as much leeway as you do in Little League.
I guarantee not.
Let's pull this analogy back to FAR Part 15. What if the contractors, the offerers, don't know how you interpret the strike zone?
It seems crazy, but it happens all the time. When I was a contracting officer, I didn't even realize I was doing it. We had one where the distance that the vehicle had to travel was, I think it was like 150 miles, right? Well, the range, we used the word range, was 150 miles. Well, the way that I interpreted that was round trip. So 300 miles is actually how far I had to travel. But what they interpreted it was 150 miles. Now it's obvious. But at the time, I'm like, oh, crap, they didn't see that coming. And it was a train wreck. But that's what I mean. It's like you got to know. I thought the strike zone was 300 miles long. They thought it was only 150.
Yeah, and it seems easy when you're reading it. You wrote it exactly what you meant. They read it and read it in a very reasonable way, but it's not the same.
Right. I've also noticed this in some of the opportunities that we're guiding our clients through, is that words like that, that they're easily interpretable different ways. The strike zone seems to move if you don't understand what it is.
So pay attention. And if it appears to have moved, make sure you've asked questions about why it appears to have moved to you. Linking this to the time zones, we're firmly in the acquisition time zones here, not execution post-award. We're pre-award in the acquisition time zones. This kind of conversation should be happening during the RFP zone and the source selection zone. In the RFP zone, the evaluation process is documented and codified. So all of the conversations and questions about the criteria and how it's going to be interpreted need to occur before that RFP is released. Once you get the RFP, you're stuck with what it says. In the source selection zone, the last zone of the acquisition time zones, the process that you documented and the rules that you laid out are executed and the results are documented. So in the RFP zone, the umpire has told you this is the final way that I am going to interpret the strike zone. And the source selection zone is the game where the umpire is actually making the calls, strike or ball, and they better stick to what they told you in the RFP zone or things go really bad.
You get crazy parents when you don't manage the strike zone.
Or in the pros, you get fans throwing beers on the field, right?
Or guys like me that go back and watch the tape when they get home and go, yeah, see, it was 2 inches off the strike zone.
I knew it. Why does the government care about the strike zone or the clarity of the evaluation criteria in the RFP?
If the umpire is not clear on what the strike zone is or what it will be, or if the government's not clear on what's important to them and how the evaluation criteria are going to be executed, people start to think it's fixed and they start polishing their protest pen to be cynical about it.
Right. They just assume that, hey, the incumbent or some favored contractor knows more than me. You're telling them more because this doesn't make any sense to me at all.
This is not entirely avoidable. I mean, you do have the cynical aspect and there are people doing this, but it's probably 80% avoidable. We can get far ahead of this by understanding ahead of time how the evaluation criteria are going to be interpreted. If the strike zone is not clear or the evaluation criteria aren't clear, then the offers in the extreme may not even want to play anymore. One of the kids on my team, he's the catcher. His name's Grayson. He gets really frustrated on some of the umpire's calls because he's the catcher. He's seeing all these. And so sometimes, well, twice now, at the middle of the game, he comes in and he's all frustrated and he's like, I don't want to play this. This is ridiculous. And he's a little kid. And he's getting himself all spun up. And it's because he feels he's not saying the contracting officer keeps changing the evaluation criteria. That's not what he's saying, but that's what he's feeling because he feels like the strike zone is moving. And that's how industry can feel if they don't clearly understand the evaluation criteria. And if in the extreme, they're like, you know what? Government market's just too hard. Yep. The strike zone is moving too much.
Yeah. And it's not so much that they're changing midstream the evaluation criteria. It's that they're not following the rules they set up. If during that plate meeting at the beginning of the game, the umpire says, I'm going to call it this way, and then they don't, that's a bad thing. And that's how you get protests. That's why we say you got to communicate up front. If Grayson is upset because the umpire said, I'm going to use the width of the plate as the strike zone, and he's calling strikes that are not over the plate, that's one thing. If Grayson's upset because the umpire said, I'm going to include the alleys, I'm going to include a ball width on either side of the plate, and that's what he's doing, then Grayson's just
a kid.
I was going to say something much more mean. Okay. What happens when people don't think that it's fair? Well, you could end up with a bench clearing brawl that delays the game and results in players or coaches being ejected, which is exactly what you're saying. Contractors may say, I don't want to deal with this government stuff anymore. It doesn't make sense. It's too hard. Bench clearing brawls also get all kinds of publicity, which while they could be good for Major League Baseball, because you know, no publicity is bad publicity, in our world, more publicity generally means that, uh-oh, now the boss or the boss's boss or the boss's boss's boss is involved. That's not fun for anyone. That means more reviews, more questions, more work to do something that should be simple if both sides clearly understood the strike zone, the rules, the interpretation before we started. I just said both sides, so let's shift to focusing on the industry side. Why does industry care?
Some of the same reasons. Bad things happen when the batter and the coach do not understand what the strike zone is. When the offer doesn't understand the evaluation criteria and then they swing anyway, but it was a ball, or they sat there frozen and watched the pitch go by and it's a strike. But I didn't realize that was a strike. You know, I missed an opportunity. You know, as an offer, you missed the perfect opportunity because you didn't realize that the strike zone, all of those things are bad. And this is compounded by the fact that, you know, in baseball, it's kind of binary. It's either a ball or a strike. You know, it's one or the other. They got to pick one, right? Whereas in proposal evaluation, there's lots of gray.
It could be a weakness. It could be a significant weakness. It could be a deficiency.
And there's a little less gray. Actually, there's a lot less gray potentially on the price side. But what if there's a most probable cost?
What if the government's doing their own evaluation of the offer's price proposal and saying, we think that it'll actually result in costing this much instead of what the offer proposed? Oh, I'm taking us way off topic. Back.
back over.
Rewind.
Yeah, most probable cost is a rabbit hole. That's for a different episode.
The bad things you're talking about, the confusion, it can be driven by a lack of clarity around the government evaluation criteria. It just may not be written in a way that's easily understandable. I think your round trip versus single direction, 300 versus 150 miles, was probably not written clearly if it left that kind of gap open for interpretation.
It was one word, range. I thought it was clear.
But the confusion could also be driven by a lack of knowledge of the requirement, the customer, the acquisition process. This is like someone that's played cricket their whole lives, where you have a bat and a ball that you're trying to hit, who decides to come play baseball and doesn't understand that they're playing a different game, that the rules are completely different. It looks the same. The commercial industry sales process might look like that's the exact same thing that the government's doing to someone that's just entering the market. It's not the same game, not the same rules. If the offer isn't targeting the agency and the requirement,
and they don't clearly understand the acquisition strategy, the evaluation criteria, and so on. In other words, they think they're playing cricket and they're playing baseball. An outcome of that could be a protest. It's an extreme, and it felt like it happened all the time when I was a contracting officer.
What we're saying is the problem isn't always a lack of understanding of the requirement, which is, what is a strike? Should I swing or not? The problem could be, what game are we playing? And if you're not targeting, you may be playing a completely different game. You may be playing cricket with the Department of Interior and baseball with the Department of Defense.
And just like you mentioned, a couple of different agencies. Even when you're reading the rule book and the application of those rules per agency, per acquisition, per requirement, per industry, you still have some uniqueness to that.
So you're saying every agency might interpret the FAR a little bit differently. They might have their own agency regulations that clarify how they interpret it, but they might not.
Right. And some of them may have a humongous supplement to the FAR, and some of them might have a small one, and some of them might not have one at all.
Okay, Kevin, with that, let's wrap this one up.
On the government side, invest the time in defining the evaluation criteria. Tell them what the strike zone is, and don't be surprised when they ask a lot of questions. You want them to ask questions at the plate meeting, not in the middle of the game. One of my favorite attorneys from Special Operations Command, a guy's name is Chris Kernan. He used what he called the 10X rule. And it's 1 hour of pre-award planning and communication could equal 10X or 10 hours of time it takes to clean up the situation during the source selection zone or post-award.
10X may actually be selling it a little short. It might be 100X if you get a protest, or 1,000X, I think. It's a lot more work later is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I wish I had learned that earlier in my career. On the industry side, to the extent that you can, figure out where the strike zone is. You can use FAR 15001, what we talked about, and 15.2 as reasoning for asking, is that this is where the FAR allows me to ask these questions. But you got to ask, here's the catch, you got to ask during the market research zone, or maybe you can ask, you can, but it's not quite as effective, it's a different approach, during the RFP zone when the RFP is out. But you can't ask during the source selection zone. Well, you can, but they're not going to tell you anything.
Right.
It's kind of like after the game is over, it's like, hey, I didn't like that call.
Too late.
Too late.
Yeah, in the market research zone, communication should be wide open. In the RFP zone, you may be able to ask questions on the RFP, but it's kind of restricted what the back and forth is, and it's probably too late. Source selection zone, no more questions.
And now is deciding time.
I'll wrap up by saying, government folks, if industry asks a lot of questions, it's because they don't understand. I've said that a bunch of times. They're not just trying to be annoying and create a lot of work for you. It's generally because they don't understand what the words say. They don't understand whether range means one way or round trip. If you get an unusually high number of questions on your draft RFP or RFP, and you don't take the time to disposition all the questions, if you don't take the time to actually update the RFP to clarify, it's pretty much a given that you're going to get a lot of confusing proposals that almost but don't quite meet the requirements that you thought you wrote. Those proposals are going to be a lot more difficult to evaluate and take a lot more time to evaluate. And the probability of a protest increases because protests are generally based on misunderstandings. Unless you clearly didn't follow your criteria, which is means you're going to lose the protest. Most protests are based on misunderstandings. And with that, I'll talk to you later, Kevin.
I see you, Paul.
Okay, that's it for this episode. Thanks to our sponsor, Skyway Acquisition. If you need help understanding the government's evaluation process, visit AskSkyway.com because Skyway guides companies like yours to winning new business. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Sorry, it just cracks me up because I've totally been there.